Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
Hey everyone. I don't know about you guys, but we have really entered into my favorite time of the year. I love the fall, specifically October. In fact, Garrett said, I think October might be my favorite month.
Yeah, I think we talked about that last week. October is by far my favorite month. If we didn't talk about it last week, I know that me and you had discussed it. It's like if I have a favorite month, it's certainly October.
Yeah.
And that is my, I love this season. It's just so much fun to me. It's a transition into the holidays and stuff.
Yeah.
And just a lot of like things to look forward to. And the weather is amazing and just continuing to get to enjoy that. I know it was amazing tonight. And so we're really getting into the fall season.
Yeah. It's been a little different with COVID and not really being sure what holidays are going to look like this year. But we have some exciting things planned in our family, and so hopefully those will, you know, go off well and everything.
Yeah.
But right now, me and Garrett have been watching some scary movies to try to get into spooky season.
We actually kind of started this last year, because I've always enjoyed, like, scary movies and stuff, and but like Melissa never really got into that, and I enjoy like a really good horror movie. If it's got a good plot, it's really hard to find horror movies that have like decent plots and stuff. So we've been trying to look for that. And last year, I think it was The Haunting of Hill House that we watched.
Yeah, and it's like a Netflix,
which is
original.
Just phenomenal. It's so freaking scary.
And actually, I think that might have been 2 years ago.
Maybe it was last year.
I think Sadie was still getting up at like, yeah, I think it must have been 2 years because she's been sleeping through the night.
Wow.
I don't know.
And time flies.
Anyways, I remember having to get up in the middle of the night with her and just having these images from that show. And I'd be like up in the middle of the night by myself and be like, we've got to stop watching this show because it's just destroying me at night because I'm so scared when I've got to get up.
And last year, me and you watched like a bunch of the Scream movies.
I'd seen parts of Scream, but I hadn't seen it all the way through. So then we watched at least two of them.
Yeah.
I don't know how many there are now, but we watched at least two different
ones. Like when you still see the girl on the cover, you're like, oh, she must make it.
Yeah, I think we might have watched three of them.
Yeah, but that was, we really got into that. And I listened to other podcasts like Lore, and REI has a really good podcast, of Camp Monsters. the first season was okay, but I listened to it whenever I was driving home from a plant trip I had to make. A few weeks ago, I listened to the two newest episodes of Camp Monsters. Just phenomenal. I like whenever it's getting dark outside and stuff, I'll turn on Lore or Camp Monsters, and we'll I'll turn it up real loud so it like kind of takes up like all of the, you know, the car and stuff, and you really get into the storytelling. And there's parts where like it'll scare me, you know, like listening to it. I just really get into that. I remember one time going down to Alabama for a work trip and having Lore on, and it had gotten dark. It was in October, so like we were getting into Halloween season, and listening to Lore, and I pull off on this like abandoned exit that has like one gas station, and there's like nothing anywhere else as far as the eye can see, and like the lights flickering, you know, and you're listening to this person tell this scary story and stuff. I love that kind of stuff. Just sitting around a campfire and basically like kind of sitting around a campfire listening to a scary story. I just dig that a lot. So that's part of the October feel for me.
Yeah. So like this week we've watched a movie on Netflix called Hush.
Yeah.
And that was pretty good. Well, both the movies, I feel like.
Yeah, they're pretty decent.
Then the last night or 2 nights ago, we watched the movie Creep.
Yeah.
And there's apparently a sequel that has like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So that was like part of why we wanted to watch the first one. It was like, if the sequel is even better, like we probably need to know what
happened. That's pretty rare that a sequel is better.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were wanting to do that. And then tonight on Netflix came out like the next season of Haunting. It's not Haunting of Hill House.
It's like a different story, but it's like the same.
Yeah, kinda. It's something. I think it's something. I can't remember.
Bly Manor or something.
Yeah, it's another season of that. That's a different story, and so I'm pretty pumped for that because that was the Haunting of Hill House was probably the greatest horror series I've seen in a long time.
Yeah,
if not ever. It was just a great suspense, good storytelling, and. It wasn't just like standard slasher stuff or anything.
Yeah,
like
it's
that.
Not
it
like
was,
scare you just for the point of scaring you. To have like a real like good meaty
you're trying
story.
To figure it out.
Yeah,
and while at the same time it is scary and stuff, and so I just really get into that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, so like the movie Hush was made by the same person.
Yeah,
or directed
Michael
or something
Flanagan.
Like,
yeah,
the same person who did the Haunting at Hill House. So that kind of intrigued us too. I think about it just because he's apparently pretty good at that.
Yeah. Definitely not for everybody, but and if you do watch him, like watch him with somebody, because I think that's what makes it fun. And that's what makes it enjoyable. It's definitely a lot more scary if you watch it by yourself. That's next level. That's not I did that one time.
Yeah, we've got to talk about this. We've got to talk about this.
Yeah, if I have I don't know if I've told this on the story on the podcast
before.
But so whenever Melissa and I were when we were still dating, we were at your parents' house and I was there all the time. I was basically, I might as well have lived there really, like, as much time as I spent at the Baldwins. But it was something that, you know, I was there all the time, but you had already gone to bed.
Yeah, you were still at my
and
house.
I was, exactly. This is case in point of what I just mentioned. She had already gone to bed and I was still up like watching, you know, movies and stuff, and Paranormal Activity was on. And I'd heard a lot of things about Paranormal Activity in the past, and I was just like, like I said, I'm a sucker for scary stuff and whatever, and I'll do that, and I'll sit and watch it. And so I turned it on and watched it start to finish. And when that movie ended, I was stuck on the couch, and I wanted to turn it off before and leave, but I just like I felt like I couldn't move. I was so scared, and I was scared mainly because it was like I was by myself, you know. Mm. And you're like watching this stuff, and it's just like it just has you. And I hate like video camera footage stuff, which is like all that is.
Yeah,
is video camera shots, and you're like peeling your eyes for like where is it gonna appear, because I guess the way that the production of that is that you assume you're watching a video camera that whatever it is isn't going to be in the center of the attention because it's a video camera.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You're expecting something to be off on the sides or like and all like and catch you somewhere. But anyways, it's just constant suspense and it doesn't change. And like you're just high strung the whole time. And I'm watching it by myself, which is a horrible decision. And in the darkness of their house, everybody's asleep, and I get to the end, and I'm literally like, I feel like I feel like my body is stuck to the couch, that I can't get up, and I don't have the courage, like, I just don't have the courage to do it. I'm just plastered there. And I finally work up the courage to go, and to go to bed, and the way that their house was is that they had like a little hallway that went down like that. You would go from the living room into the foyer. There's a little hallway that goes down into the kitchen. And as I'm passing by that hallway, the ice maker, just it, it, uh, shifted, and I freaking lost it. And I started running up the stairs.
High stepping.
And, of course, being, you know, a loving boyfriend, I go and check on Melissa and make sure she's okay.
There's kind of a theme here where Garrett wakes me up for something. You know, like, he woke me up from a Sunday afternoon nap to get the bird out of our house.
That's right.
And now he's waking me up, and he said, I was like, what are you doing? And he said, I just wanted to make sure you were okay. And I was like, I was, until you woke me up.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he was really needing someone to make sure he was okay, but didn't want to seem.
I had a bad history. So I don't want to tell too many stories, just because the time's gonna go. But yeah, like, so I have a history of doing that type of thing. But one time it was like watching Amityville Horror with my dad.
Did you check on your dad?
And dad was asleep.
Dad
was asleep, and I was like, hey, dad. You know, it was like, there's a little scene where, like, the face or eyes appear in the window.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if you ever look out your window and somebody's standing there in the middle of the night, no thank you.
Yeah.
No. You know, like, I don't care who you are. Like, that. Yeah. Nobody wants to see that. But anyways, that there's, like, a little scene that happens, and I was like, it's almost like how Caleb does, you know, where he's like, Mom.
Oh my goodness.
In the middle of the night.
It's like a. Oh, it's He'll like get a up at 2
in the
now.
Morning and be like, Mom.
I need to go to the bathroom.
And so you slowly wake up to, Mom. But anyways, so I basically do that to my dad, and I'm like, Dad. And he's asleep, and he worked like second shift and stuff, so he was asleep. And I finally woke him up. He was like, what do you want? I was just like, I just wanted to see if you're awake.
All right. So we should have known about this.
Yeah. Well, and then there's another, like, ghost story or whatever at Dad's house. But we maybe can save that for later.
Oh, yeah.
But maybe next week. Yeah, maybe next week I'll tell the story or my ghost story from my dad's house. But anyways, all that to say, like, I've just... It gets me going, this kind of stuff. It just is fun to me, whatnot. But anyways, so that I love fall, and these are kind of things that go with it. And just the, I don't know, spooky stories and falling leaves and cornhole and, you know, doing different stuff like that outside and all of that. I just really enjoy.
Yeah.
So we're gonna pick up now in Exodus chapter 13. It feels like it's been a long time since the 10th plague started, you know, like, or whenever mm-hmm. we kind of first touched on that. But a lot of that is because we've had a lot of liturgy that's come up along the way. Part of it is the Feast of Unleavened Bread and how to observe Passover and stuff. And we covered all of those. But I think it was last week that we actually had the death of the firstborn. And the story finally progresses to the point where the Israelites are leaving Egypt. So we're kind of in the middle of that narrative of them leaving Egypt. And they are... They're progressing to, you know, where they're going to start moving towards the wilderness. But again, here in 13, we're going to have the narrative interrupted again. And it feels really unusual to us. It's like, I wouldn't do that. You know, like, if I was writing a story, if I was writing a narrative, this isn't the way that I would write it. So it feels kind of odd to us. But I think in the context of the story, and I think as we read through this, we're going to realize kind of the importance of this and why it's brought up. But we're going to have it interrupted again, kind of talking about some liturgical things. Of what to do, and primarily thinking about whenever they get into the promised land, the way that they're going to honor the things that have happened. And so that's what we're going to enter into mostly in chapter 13. So we'll just go ahead and jump right in. You're going to read verses 1 through what?
16.
Mm-hmm. All right, so go ahead.
All right. The Lord said to Moses, consecrate to me every firstborn male. The first offspring of every womb among the Israelites belongs to me, whether man or animal. Then Moses said to the people, commemorate this day, the day you came out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery, because the Lord brought you out brought you out of it with a mighty hand. Eat nothing containing yeast. Today, in the month of Abib, you are leaving. When the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, and Jebusites, the land he swore to your forefathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you are to observe this ceremony in this month. For 7 days, eat bread made without yeast, and on the seventh day, hold a festival to the Lord. Eat unleavened bread during those 7 days. Nothing with yeast is to be seen among you, nor shall any yeast be seen anywhere within your borders. On that day, tell your son, I do this because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. This observance will be for you like a sign on your hand and a reminder on your forehead that the law of the Lord is to be on your lips. For the Lord brought you out of Egypt with his mighty hand. You must keep this ordinance at the appointed time year after year. After the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and gives it to you, as he promised on oath to you and your forefathers, you are to give over to the Lord the first offspring of every womb. All the firstborn males of your livestock belong to the Lord. Redeem with a lamb every firstborn donkey, but if you do not redeem it, break its neck. Redeem every firstborn among your sons. In days to come, when your son asks you, "What does this mean?" say to him, "With a mighty hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed every firstborn in Egypt, both man and animal. This is why I sacrifice to the Lord the first male offspring of every womb and redeem each of my firstborn sons. And it will be like a sign on your hand and a symbol on your forehead that the Lord brought us out of Egypt with his mighty hand."
All right, so one thing, I guess I want to start out by mentioning, and this is kind of something that, like, meditating over it or really, like, reading over it a bunch of times that I've come to realize with this, mm-hmm. is there's a structure to it. Chapter 13 in the reading that you just did, it could probably be broken down even more than what I'm going to do right now, but it's like an A-B-A-B. So you have a liturgical instruction, and then why do I give the instruction? So that the children may know, right? Mm-hmm. And we'll kind of get into that then again. And then you get verse 11, and whenever he brings you out of the Canaanite to fulfill a promise, he just said that earlier, whenever he brings you into the land of the Canaanites, here's what you should do. Why? There's the B again, so that your children may know, right? So there's a really cool, I think, A-B-A-B structure to this. It's not willy-nilly, and it's not like, he just said the same thing twice. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's sometimes how we phrase it. But it's a structure. It's a very deliberate structure. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point that out just so that you could probably almost bracket it and see, like, where the instruction is, and then why the instruction, and the instruction, and then why the instruction again. And kind of lay that out and just see how artistic it is. And you could probably even pull out even more sections than that on things that are repeated, like, or I guess the way things are said, like, again, like the promise begins in this first part, the promise is going to be repeated again in verse 11, you know, so it's like kind of it's very much structured. Mm-hmm. But anyways, to go back to the front of chapter 13, I think one thing that, like, one question I think that you had whenever we talked was, like, what do you mean, what does it mean to consecrate?
Yeah, I feel like that's a word that I've seen and read a lot, but I've never stopped and asked myself, what does that really mean?
Yeah, and so it's a very churchy word to us, I guess. It's very Christianese, I suppose. To consecrate, is to make it holy, to set something apart, right? Mm-hmm. It's the root word is kadosh. It's the word holy, make it holy. And then, like, so for instance, in Isaiah chapter 6, whenever the cherubim or seraphim, whenever they're surrounding, God's throne, they're saying, "Holy, holy, holy," right? This is the Lord God Almighty kind of thing. That's the same root is right there. These are two saying the same things, that God is holy. He's three times holy. Right. And this is saying, hey, you know, make holy, set apart. What's another word? Sanctify this firstborn. And what does that mean? It means that you're acknowledging that the firstborn belongs to Yahweh. And so the firstborn has been something that's come up a lot, right? This has been something that we just talked about in the plague, that the firstborns died, right? And then also the firstborns were also spared,
mm-hmm.
for Israel. And so I guess it's highlighting that the first fruits of everything, it all belongs to God, and it's all a gift from God. And the idea here is to consecrate that thing so that you recognize that it belonged to Yahweh, and it's a gift. To have a child is a gift. And there's going to be more on that as we go through this chapter, but it seems like it starts out with that, and then it transitions away from it, and then it's going to come back to it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of what this is getting at, is it's just highlighting the holiness or the gift that a firstborn would be. The way you consecrate it, though, isn't really talked about yet, right?
Right.
That's something that's going to come here in a little bit. But anyway, so consecrate, make holy, set this thing apart. The firstborn of everything. It belongs to me, says Yahweh. Right? And he tells them, and then Moses goes and tells the people to remember this day that you went out from Egypt, from the house of slaves, because of the strength of hand of Yahweh brought you out from here. So that word strength, that's the same. It's the same word for the same root word there is for the hardened. So whenever Pharaoh's, heart was hardened, that's the same word. I think I'll probably butcher this, hazik. But that's that same word for hardened Pharaoh's heart. This is now using it for a positive sense, in that Yahweh's strength brought them out of Egypt.
So something as we're kind of going into this section, something that I noticed as we were reading it was that it seems like Moses is talking to them as though he's not a part of their group.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of reminding me of early Exodus Moses, who felt like a foreigner in his, in the land because of how he was born an Israelite, raised by Egyptians, married a Midianite?
Yes.
Woman. And just how he just never really seemed early on to have a place where he belonged. And so the way he's talking to the people here kind of reminded me of that. So I don't know exactly what's going through his mind here, if he just doesn't identify necessarily as a slave. Something Garrett and I have talked about is that what we come to find in Exodus is that when the people are out of slavery, they still kind of behave like slaves.
Right.
Or sort of want to kind of retreat.
They're stuck in the past.
Yeah, and that's something that we'll
get into as we get into the wilderness. They're stuck in their past. And not only that, they misremember their past.
Right.
So, like, they can't, they're like, oh, the cucumbers of Egypt. It's like, we didn't even have to work. And it's like, mm-hmm. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Like, the story was that you guys were ground out of the dust. You cried out to Yahweh. He mm-hmm. came and saved you. And now all you can think about is, like, the melons and the cucumbers of Egypt. And it was all free.
Yeah.
Like, you totally misremember the whole situation.
Yeah. So it's interesting here, because I do kind of wonder if he's like, well, I never was really living as a slave. But the other thing, and I think this is probably more where I fall with this, is that this whole idea is that Moses is like the mouthpiece for God
mm-hmm.
in this moment. And so really, this is all God speaking through Moses here. And so, of course, he's not, slave.
I think there's a point to be made in that Moses wasn't a slave.
Right.
Moses came in
to
their slavery to redeem them for their slavery.
Yeah.
Is this ringing any bells, for us? He entered into their slavery with them. I mean, he didn't necessarily become a slave, but he entered into their situation so that he could redeem them from their situation.
It kind of brought us to this conversation of, we don't really know what Moses was doing day in and day out, like during the plagues.
Yeah.
Of, working alongside the people. Where was he, like, sleeping? There's a lot we don't really know about. But I just thought that it was interesting how that his perspective here is, it feels more like God talking to the people than it does necessarily Moses. Like, if you didn't have, then Moses said to the people, you might would think that this was just directly coming from mm-hmm. God's mouth, you know?
Yeah.
So I just thought that was something kind of interesting, or it stuck out to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a great point. I just think that there's a lot of emulations here to me between Moses
and
things that Jesus does. It's that, you know, this righteous intercessor comes in and, you know, intercedes for, you know, on Yahweh's behalf and enters into the slavery of these people so that he can redeem his firstborn. It's just, I mean, there's just so many things firing, I think, for me in this story and how this overlays with the story of Jesus. And also, so as we go through here, what if you've listened to any of the previous ones, you're going to hear this stuff about the yeast,
mm-hmm.
right? Of that whenever you go, and so he talks about whenever you go into the land, he's mentioning the promise, right? He says, today you're going out in the month of Abib, and whenever Yahweh brings you to the land of Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, this should all ring bells for us. This is a repeat mm-hmm. of a promise that was given, that God is starting to fulfill his promise. And whenever he does fulfill his promise that he swore to your ancestors, you're to commemorate this with this unleavened bread. That this food without yeast will be eaten, you know, and that you can't have any yeast. We've already talked about this before, and the Bible is repeating it. It's like if the Bible repeats something, especially within a couple chapters, it feels like it's probably important, and we should probably pay attention to it. Actually, this seems to be mentioned more. It's been mentioned more than even the Passover meal itself.
Mm-hmm.
The Passover meal itself was talked about briefly, and going over how to do that. But this is now like the second time to talk about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's not going to talk about the Passover feast anymore. It's going to talk about this is the second time of Feast of Unleavened Bread. So maybe we're supposed to think about this a little bit more. And so I put some thought to it. And thinking about yeast and the way that it works with bread, it's almost like whenever you have this dough and you put yeast in it, the yeast works itself out all the way through the bread. It doesn't just stay in one place. It works its way through it. Almost, it's like an infection.
You know what it kind of reminds me of now?
What?
The symbiote, the Spider-Man.
Okay. So it's like the Venom suit.
That's what happens when you have a 4-year-old boy.
Okay. Yeah. And it starts bringing out all this, you know, negative energy, whatever, with the symbiote suit. Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of like the symbiote suit, but it acts like an infection. It works its way through the whole of the bread so that it's a part of every part. You can no longer separate the yeast out from the bread.
Yeah, the symbiote suit.
So you can no longer...
Venom.
You can no longer have, like, take the yeast out without destroying the whole thing, right? And so, anyways, that's the way that yeast behaves, is that it works its way through the whole of the bread. And it's almost like... what God is saying to them is hey, whenever you make dough, remove the yeast so that it doesn't infect the yeast. Completely purify the dough. And you're going to bake the unleavened bread in its purity. And so the symbols behind it seem to be that, to me, I'm reading this and seeing them coming out of Egypt in this yeast of their slavery. The yeast of the slavery that they've been told that, hey, you know, this is who you are. You belong to me and you don't have the right to leave this place. And they've been beaten down in their slavery. And God is trying to remove that from them and say, you know, this isn't who you are. And unless they remove it, they're going to continue, even when they're free, they're going to continue to live in that slavery because they don't know any other way. And so he's taking them out into the wilderness. He's going to purify them in the wilderness. They're going to be yeast, or they're going to be bread without yeast in the wilderness. He's going to purify them in the wilderness and bake them hard so that they will last. One thing about unleavened bread is that it lasts a really long time. I had some matzah sitting in the cupboard in the pantry probably for a couple years, you know, where we did a Passover meal. and it was perfectly fine. I used it to eat some what is that dip?
To be fair, Garrett notoriously eats things long after their expiration.
But it was great. It was still in great shape. It didn't mold. You know, that's what it does. Whenever there's leaven in the bread, it rots really fast. You know, we just threw a whole loaf of bread away today, or not today, but maybe yesterday, day before. Whole loaf of bread that was untouched, dagnabbit, and we threw it away because it had mold in it. Well, the mold is able to grow up because the yeast that's in the bread. If there wasn't yeast in the bread and it was unleavened bread, it would last for, you know, forever. And so I think there's an aspect of that, of like removing the impurities from it, baking it in the wilderness, or baking them in the wilderness was supposed to have some lasting effect on them so that they could go forward. So I think there's just different aspects of that.
I think in general here, though, we would view yeast then as a negative thing.
Absolutely.
That it represents some sort of sin or, I don't know, another
word. Or wickedness. Wickedness or unholiness. That which is common, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they couldn't eat bread with yeast. They couldn't eat it during these holy days. And there would never be a point, there wouldn't be a point where they would take bread with yeast before Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would have unleavened bread that would go before Yahweh. So anyways, those are the things. Did you have some thoughts on that? I'm going to mention some other things, but were you going to talk about some stuff?
So my mom, she listened to the last, I guess, I don't remember which podcast it was, but we had kind of talked, and, you know, there was a part where it was like, if anyone eats yeast, they're going to be cut off from your family or cut off from the rest of the Israelites. And we talked about how difficult, like, of a thing that was to hear, you know, mm-hmm. of like, well, that seems really harsh and everything. And my mom, she said something to us that said, that was like, to have people in the midst of his family with so little regard for God would certainly begin to affect the whole family, like as a whole. And that kind of sparked a thought in me of if you're in a family, or let's just say just me and Garrett, if Garrett is trying to diet and he really needs to lose weight, which he doesn't, by the way, he's lost a lot of weight in quarantine, but let's say he was trying to lose weight and I keep bringing in, and I'm not trying to lose weight. And so I'm sitting there eating, you know, cake and donuts and all, you know, all sorts of things that would not be helpful to his diet. It's going to make it really hard for him to lose weight because that has been entered into it's in our home. It's hard to, it makes that self-control a little bit more difficult. And so I think, in a sense, that yeast is kind of the same way. Even if it's just a little bit coming into your family, it tends to just spread throughout your family. And I think that's where you're going to go to with the parable.
So, I mean, I love the thought behind that. And I think that that is exactly what the way that they would picture that, of the idea of this yeast or this leaven working its way throughout the whole batch. And wickedness has a way of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it just, you know, it starts in one little thing and then it just spreads all the way throughout. For instance, with Paul would pick up this exact imagery.
Yeah.
In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, look at it. But I mean, there's sexual immorality that's going on with the Corinthians and stuff. But he says, your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole batch of dough?
Mm-hmm.
Clean out the old leaven in order that you may be a new batch of dough, just as you are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed. So then, let us celebrate the feast, not with the old leaven or with the leaven of wickedness and sinfulness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And so that's like I was talking about, that pulling out of the wickedness mm-hmm. and purifying the bread, right? And purifying this group of people. So the leaven is used symbolically to show, hey, you know, the yeast is like the wickedness that's among you. Remove it.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me, you know, that Paul doesn't have Exodus chapters 12 and 13 on his mind whenever he's writing this very thing.
Yeah.
He talks about the Passover, the unleavened bread. If you don't know Exodus chapter 12 and 13, you're going to have very little chance of really grasping everything that Paul's trying to get at here. Can you grasp it? Absolutely. Are you going to get the whole picture of it and the whole view of it if you don't understand Exodus? No, you're not.
Yeah.
You can't.
And I think that also helps us to see that this not eating it with yeast in it is a symbol, is an expression of what's going on inside our hearts. Going on. And that was something else my mom brought up, was like, I think sometimes we tend to think that some things in the Old Testament are not about our hearts. It's about doing things a certain way. And then in the New Testament, it's like, oh, now it's about the heart. And right. like when really it's been about the heart all along.
Yeah. Here. I mean, and that's what the prophets would say. They would say, guys, don't you understand what the Torah is about?
Mm-hmm.
It's about render your hearts, not your garments.
Right.
You know, tear your heart apart is what they're saying. Tear your heart apart, not just stand there and rip your garments apart. I mean, the outer should reflect the inner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but whenever it's just the outer, it doesn't matter that much. But whenever the outer is truly reflecting what's within, that's when it matters.
Yeah.
And that's what the prophets are trying to get at, is they're being like, dude, you guys have misunderstood the Torah. It's about, you know, seeking justice, loving mercy, walking humbly with God. And, you know, they would all like key in on that type of stuff of mm-hmm. like, it's about what you're doing inside. You know, that you guys have a hard heart and you need to do something about that.
Yeah.
And so another example, again, I mean, this is the way that Jesus would pick up this leaven idea. This is with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This is in Matthew chapter 16. And he said, and when the disciples arrived at the other side, they crossed over the lake. He says, they had forgotten to take bread. And Jesus said to them, watch out for and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. So they were discussing this among themselves, saying, it's because we didn't take bread. So they're like, their natural response is like, he's ticked off because we forgot to take the bread, which is not at all what he's trying to do. But that's like their first response, because they don't know what he's doing. And he said, but knowing this, Jesus said, why are you discussing among yourselves that you did not take bread, you of little faith? Do you not yet understand? Or do you not remember the 5 loaves and the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Or the 7 loaves or the 4,000 and how many baskets you took up? So two instances of him feeding, you know, thousands of people. And they're sitting here being like, oh, he's mad because we forgot to get bread. How do you not understand that I did not speak to you about bread, but beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Then they understood that he did not say to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So he compares Jesus again. He'll pick up the leaven
mm-hmm.
and he'll start applying it to the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So this is still negative connotation, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the way that they're working their way through the whole batch.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this would be highly provocative, you know, to say something like this. And so this is where this really gets really good. We've seen leaven.
There's more.
We've seen yeast before in Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's in one of, I think he tells 7 different parables, like a good Jewish man. Jesus tells 7 different parables. And one of those, maybe his shortest parable, he said, and he told them another parable. This is Matthew chapter 13, 32. I'm sorry, 33. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and put it into 3 measures of wheat flour until the whole batch was leavened. Think about that. Think about, you're a Jewish person hearing that. You know the story of the Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how we were supposed to, like, during this holy time, We're not supposed to do that. And now Jesus is sitting here saying the kingdom of heaven, God's very kingdom, is like yeast.
That doesn't sound right. That doesn't sound good.
Like, we just talked about how negative everything was about yeast. Yeah. And now Jesus is flipping it on its head. It's like, what are you doing? You know, like, this is very provocative. Like, this is going to stir up some trouble, right? And so his point isn't that. So here he's not saying, hey, the kingdom of heaven is like wickedness. Mm-hmm. That's not what he's saying.
Yeah.
He's using the same metaphor in a different way, in a way that's going to incite them to be like, oh, I need to think about this. Or it's going to close off the hearts of the Pharisees that are listening to him. They're going to be like, their hearts are going to grow hard because they're going to be like, this maniac is saying that the kingdom of heaven is like yeast. Doesn't he know the scriptures?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what they're going to do. They're going to harden their heart to it and not listen to what he's actually saying. And his point seems to be that whenever we take it in its full context is that, listen, there's going to be people in the kingdom that you feel like don't belong here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be there. They're going to be part of the kingdom. And the people that you think belong in the kingdom aren't going to be a part of the kingdom. There's a whole, if you go listen on East Brainerd Church of Christ podcast, Sean White does a whole sermon on, it's called Growth. If you go look up Growth underneath their podcast, he did a great job just talking about this, talking about how the yeast gets worked throughout all of the scriptures and how it's used. But the point seems to be that yeast isn't necessarily always a negative. It's a symbol. It's something to be picked up and used in a way that's like, okay, how can I tell this story so that you can understand this? And the Exodus story, it's about wickedness. And for Paul, it's about wickedness. For Jesus, sometimes it's about wickedness, but it's also about goodness too. It's about the kingdom of heaven. And just the same, it seems like just as wickedness takes and spreads throughout, so will the kingdom of heaven. You know, like whenever it's planted, it's going to spread throughout. It's going to go everywhere, just like with the mustard seed. So the previous parable is about the mustard seed. It gets planted in the ground, you know, this small, tiny seed, and it grows up, and all the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. You know, and it's this big kingdom that things that you think don't, you know, shouldn't be there are there. I think that the point here is that the leaven, whatever it's being used for, it's like this thing is able to spread throughout. And it can infect it,
mm-hmm.
or it could be something that gives something life and changes its composure, changes everything about it, one way, for bad or for good.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's a really interesting metaphor. It's like things are not always used the same way in the scriptures, but like it's almost like whenever it changes, it's there to shock you. You know, and to make you really think. It's like Jonah. You know, Jonah's a prophet of God. You think, oh, this is going to be a great story about a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a horrible story about a prophet. Like, it's something that, like, the prophet doesn't do anything he's supposed to do. It's supposed to shock you and jar you. That's the way that the scriptures are awesome to me.
I think this whole discussion on the yeast has really brought out to me how reading and understanding the Old Testament can really enhance the New Testament for
us.
And how if we were to only study the New Testament, we would miss out on so many things. Like, we just wouldn't understand them in the way we were maybe supposed to understand them with having read all the scripture.
Yeah.
And so that's what's been really cool to me with this, specifically this chapter, is where it really has brought it out to me with all these scriptures from Matthew. And I think especially the parable there has just kind of reshaped the way. Because I think if you're mainly studying the New Testament and you're reading about yeast and stuff and you don't have this in the back of your mind, there's just so much you're missing, especially since this is such a significant time. In the history of the Israelites.
Yeah, this is setting the tone.
This is huge. This is a huge moment, and we are constantly getting bombarded about the no yeast, no yeast, no yeast. Like, how they're kind of in the past two chapters, you're like, we get the point.
Right.
No yeast.
You think you do.
Yeah. You think you do. You're like, okay, enough. You don't have to remind us again.
But it's precisely the repetition that really made me think about it.
Yeah.
And that really made me ponder the whole point. Like, what is it? What's it about it? Like, I didn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But the repetition forced me to be like, I feel like I'm really supposed to know what's going on here.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't explain it that way, you know, but it takes some thought and some meditation on the scriptures to be like, what does this mean? And then, I think it makes you seek it out. It's like God wants you to seek him. And so I think that's what this does. It's phenomenal. I love that.
So going back more focused in again on Exodus 13, you know, we've obviously lots of unleavened bread talk. So now kind of moving down into this idea of the observance will be for you like a sign on your hand and a reminder on your forehead that the law of the Lord is to be on your lips. And that's in verse 9. And to me, when I read this, I feel like I'm starting to ask better questions because I'm like, what is the law of the Lord in this case? Because we're not to the point where we've had necessarily any laws laid down. We've had very few commands up to this point. I think we've talked about before on another podcast that up to this point, it's narrative.
Yeah, it's narrative.
And so to me, I'm like, well, what is he talking about? The law of the Lord is to be on your lips. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, and first off, and it'll be a sign to you on your hand and a memorial between your eyes. So it's something that's like going to be ever before you. No matter what you do, this thing is going to be before you so that the law of the Lord, so that word Torah right there, this collection of five, it's called the Torah.
Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers.
Deuteronomy. That's right. Yes. Yeah. So those five, they're the Torah. But it even more, I mean, that word Torah means instruction. So a lot of times we translate it as law. I think that's somewhat problematic because of the way that we think about law.
Yeah.
And we impose our ideas of what law is onto this culture.
Well, I mean, you heard me just say like commands.
Exactly.
And so that's not
And it's not necessarily that they're not like commands. I mean, they are. It's just the way that they worked for these people was very different than the way that the laws work for us. I mean, again, think about just think about how judges work in our society. Our judges work by, they say, we don't care about anything about our religious background and things like, I mean, that's been a huge topic right now with the, you know, replacing, you know, Supreme Court justice and stuff. And it's like, hey, are you going to allow your religious beliefs to come in on all of this stuff? And I guess the idea of the way our law works is to say that none of that should matter. It's only by the book that we judge, right? It says that if this is the way that the law says it, that's what we follow, right? That's the way law works for us. For people in this culture, judges worked off of wisdom. For instance, the very main like wise judge court scene that we know of, that everybody seems to know of in the Bible, is King Solomon dealing with two women, right, and a baby, and his massive wisdom. You know, it's like he doesn't consult a law book, he doesn't consult the Torah on how to do it, he consults wisdom. And so he uses like different, I mean, it's not that, you know, this doesn't help build his wisdom. But there's no law that says, like, hey, whenever two women show up and they each have a baby, here's how you're supposed to execute justice. That's just not, like, that wasn't the way that it worked. And for us, we would approach that differently. And so it's a paradigm shift for us to think about what law is or what the Torah is versus what law is for us. It's just two different things. So I think it's better for us to, I think the better translation of it is the instruction of Yahweh. But in this context, what's the instruction of Yahweh supposed to do? The instruction of Yahweh being ever before you, being on your forehead and on your hands, being reminders, what are they supposed to do? They're supposed to remind you of something. They're supposed to tell you a story of who God is. That with a strong hand, Yahweh brought you out from Egypt. That's what the Torah is supposed to do. It's supposed to be an ever constant reminder of who God is and what he did for you. That's what it's supposed to do. Having those things on you aren't making you like more pure and things like that. It's being a constant reminder of God's grace. And through that constant reminder, it changes who you are. You know, it forces you to live in that grace, having that constant reminder. Again, they're no longer slaves. They are, you know, they're children. They're the firstborn of Yahweh. And having this in front of them and doing these things is that constant reminder of this is what Yahweh did for us. So again, that's how this is structured. It's like liturgy, thing to do. Why are we doing it? So that we can remember what Yahweh did for us. And then we're going to see it happen again in verses, starting in verse 11. Did I touch on the things that you thought that you were hoping?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to see that happen again, the same sort of structure starting in verse 11. Now we're going to pick back up with the firstborn again. Again, whenever you come into the land of the Canaanites, there's the promise again, talking about, you know, what was sworn to the ancestors. You'll hand over your firstborn, right? Hand over every first offspring of the womb to Yahweh and every first offspring dropped by a domestic animal that will belong to you. The males will be for Yahweh, and every first offspring of a donkey you will redeem with small livestock. And if you won't redeem it, then you're going to break the neck of the donkey. And every firstborn human among you, your sons, you will redeem. So we're getting back to the consecration of the firstborns that started this chapter out. So it seems to me that the way that they consecrate the firstborn, the firstborn belongs to Yahweh. And so they redeem the firstborn by sacrificing this lamb, just like they did in the Passover. That lamb seemed to represent in some way the firstborn of the household. And whenever they saw the blood, the destroyer saw the blood, they would pass over. Right. And so they're told to consecrate the firstborn. And the way that it seems to be that they do that is they sacrifice a lamb in his place to redeem that child. And this isn't the first time that this has happened in the story. I think the last time, or at least the first time that it happened, is the story of Isaac. As Isaac and Abraham go up the mountain, and he's going to take back the firstborn of Abraham, because who gave the firstborn? Who gave Isaac? That was Yahweh himself. Isaac belongs to Yahweh. And Abraham doesn't bat an eye. You know, he's like, okay, yeah, he belongs to you. And what happens is that the child is redeemed through that which Yahweh provides. Yahweh provides this goat, this ram on the mountain, and Abraham redeems his son through the lamb, through this ram. And so that is repeated now here. And the whole point is that they're remembering the Passover and how God provided a substitute, so that their child could be redeemed. Just fun facts. This is the first time that the word for redemption has occurred in the Bible. So this right here, anytime you think of the word redeem, this is the first time it happens. So you have any other thoughts on this section?
It helps me to think about the meaning of the word redeem, that buy back kind of concept.
Yeah.
Because I feel like redeem is one of those like majorly churchy words that we don't really think about what it really means very often.
Yeah.
And we're just like, you just are supposed to kind of know without actually digging in and being like, okay, what is to be redeemed?
So. Yeah, and I think another good word for that is ransom.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've ever seen a good, you know, I guess a good movie where somebody's like taking somebody for ransom, right? Just like that, you know, there's like a price to be paid so that you can get your kid back or whatever. Just the same, so this redemption or ransoming of the Israelites, they've been taken captive by Pharaoh. And God has ransomed them. He's bought them back at a price.
Yeah.
And it's a hard price, you know. It was really hard for us to read that price.
Yeah.
They're bought back at a price. They're ransomed out of their slavery back into freedom. And so that, I think that's the way that the biblical story is going to continue, is this constant ransoming of the Israelites and God's children, that he goes and buys back his children.
And I love how, as we continue and it repeats again, like you were saying, of what does this mean? And the response is, with a mighty hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. And we're kind of getting that reminder of exactly what we were talking about with the law of the Lord being on your lips, of sharing, of this idea of constantly sharing with others what the Lord has done for you.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's a real point of emphasis here. And reading through it this time kind of reminded me of the Great Commission, of it's, you know, go out and share, you know, essentially go out and tell about me, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what's happening here. Go out and tell about what the Lord has done for you.
Yeah.
And so I like that parallel, and just kind of seeing of, you know, it should be evident to others that something has happened in our lives to kind of make us react differently to things that are otherwise maybe negative in our lives.
Yeah.
The way we respond to different circumstances and the joy that we might have and the peace that we might have about certain situations, that's kind of how it is sort of metaphorically on our foreheads.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Well, and I just can't imagine, you know, think about, it's just really hard for us to get into the idea of it, but if I was to take my now 4-year-old son,
mm-hmm.
and I was to take him to Jerusalem, and we were to ascend the stairs of the temple, and I've got little Lammy in my hand.
Lammy?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to him, he's been hanging out with this little lamb for a little bit. You know, he's gotten to know him. And we go up, we ascend the stairs, or, you know, maybe we've ceremonially washed, you know, and I take him, and we go to the temple. And we go and see the priest, and we go through all this stuff, and he watches little Lammy die on the altar.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at me, you know, and he says, "Daddy, why do we do this?"
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's like the story is supposed to be that you look at him and you say, "Because God thought you were precious,
mm-hmm.
and he redeemed you, and he redeemed me out of Egypt, you know, so that we could be here and that we could worship God in freedom." And that's the story, buddy. You know, and like, think of how that's going to be locked into his mind.
Oh, yeah.
Is that that's who God is, that he's a redeeming God, that he saved us out of Egypt, and that he's brought our nation to where we are. And so to think about it like that, and to realize how much of a marker that would be in your life and why that would be so identifying. And somehow that's supposed to be even more for me right now, that I'm supposed to be able to tell my son a story to, you know, that he's supposed to at some point look at me and say, "Daddy, why do we do these things?"
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you know, because our God is a redeeming God, and because he died and he redeemed me and he has restored me to as a new creation. And, you know, he loves us. That's why we do these things, buddy. You know, and so, like, to think about that story being told, that's, you know, it's not these bland words of the Exodus. Like, these are really, really impressionable stories that, you know, and why these kids would ask what's going on. Just as an example, I mean, this happens in the New Testament. So this is like the very first thing that happens whenever Jesus is born. In Luke chapter 2, verse 22, it says, And when the days of their purification were completed, according to the law of Moses, they brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, just as it is written in the law of the Lord, every male that opens the womb will be called holy to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice according to what was stated in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or 2 young pigeons. And so that statement there is kind of showing that they're poor. They don't have a lot to give. They don't have a little. They can't afford little Lammy. Instead, it's these 2 turtle doves. But anyway, so, you know, this is something that was still going on, and this is happening with Jesus, the true firstborn, the one that would represent Israel, that would represent all of humanity. That this one firstborn, this is what happened. This very story is what is carried forward in Luke. So we're gonna. transition now to, we're going to pick up in verse 17. And when Pharaoh released the people, God did not lead them the way of the land of the Philistines, though it was nearer, because God said, lest the people change their mind when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the way of the desert to the Red Sea. And the Israelites went up in battle array from the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, because Joseph had made the Israelites solemnly swear an oath, saying, God will surely attend to you, and you will take up my bones from here with you. And they set out from Succoth, and they encamped at Etham on the edge of the desert. And Yahweh was going before them by day in a column of cloud to lead them on the way, and by night in a column of fire to give light to them to go by day and night. The column of cloud by day and the column of fire by night did not depart from before the people.
Okay, so we're kind of back to the narrative.
Yep. Well, like, all of a sudden, the narrative's so much shorter.
It feels a lot easier to understand.
Yeah. So
we're picking up, and we already have this situation where God is showing just how well he knows his people.
Yeah.
He's leading them down a path that is going to take longer, and maybe in some ways be challenging, but he doesn't want them to go through the area of the Philistines, because if they get in some sort of disagreement, argument that escalates into battles and whatnot, then they might decide, hey, you know, we really were better off in Egypt. And that goes back to what Garrett was saying earlier of, like, they kind of have this messed up view of what Egypt really was for them.
Right. And also, I mean, it seems like there just needs to be more that happens with them. Could God just take them and say, you know, all right, I'm going to transport you from Egypt. Plop, you're in the Holy Land.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, but if you do that, then the things that maybe that he wants his people to be don't get accomplished.
Yeah. I think we can see in our own lives that our growth really happens when we're struggling through something.
Yeah.
When we're wrestling with scripture, we have a lot more growth with scripture.
Yes, absolutely.
And an understanding of God. And so I think that's definitely the situation here. It also, reading this again, has kind of reminded me too that, like, sometimes we have a certain way in our heads that we think things should go, and we don't understand why we seem to be going this alternate path.
Right.
And that maybe there really is a purpose behind it. Maybe it's coincidence, maybe it's not.
Yeah, I mean, that God's maybe leading you this way so that you don't just get discouraged in this other thing.
Yeah.
And so,
and I mean, obviously we know he's going to use the Red Sea in a significant way.
Right. Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, it's almost like you know that you see that because you already know the story.
Yeah.
If you're in the story, you're like, what on earth are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, why are you leaning? But it's like this big cloud and this big column of fire, so I guess I'm supposed to go with it. It doesn't, you know, it's like backseat drivers, like, or like Caleb, you know, anytime I turn away that he doesn't think, he's like, are we going the right way?
Okay, this is perfect example of this is we were leaving this barbecue place, and to go to our church building where we were going to go play on the playground, you needed to turn left. And Garrett turned right because it's really hard to turn left out of this place. And Caleb was like, whoa, you're going the wrong way. This is not the way to the church building. This is not the way to the playground.
He's like, Daddy, I don't know if you know, but this is not the right way to the church.
And Garrett's like, no, I'm going to turn around, buddy. And he's like, it doesn't seem like you're turning around.
He's second guessing me the whole way. And it's like, dude, I just bought you dinner, and now you're complaining in the back seat, and I know where I'm going. Will you please be quiet? Yeah, so I can imagine, you know, these people are probably thinking the same thing. They're like, God, don't you know
over that way?
Moses, can you talk to him, please? And so anyways, I there's something to be said there with that, of that him leading, going the long way around. So and he leads them to the edge of the desert, right? At the Red Sea. So fun fact with this, Red Sea kind of carries over from King James. The words there, it's Yam Suf. There's the Hebrew word Yam Suf. And it's literally the Sea of Reeds. So there's been some discussion back and forth on what does this mean. I mean, we have an idea of what the Red Sea is, of what this place is they arrive at. It's the Sea of Reeds. And so a lot of people, scholars look at it and they say, look, the Red Sea is salt water. And, you know, reeds don't grow, papyrus doesn't grow in salt water. So why, if this is actually the Red Sea, as you would picture it on a map, if this is actually the Red Sea, why would it be called, why, if that's where they crossed, why would it be called the Sea of Reeds? And so there's some different arguments and stuff on what that, you know, what all this means. Where did they actually cross over? There's maybe like a little leg that sticks up on the, I think it's on the Sinai Peninsula, where there's potentially like a bunch of fresh water that flows down into the Red Sea. And that right there is where all of it happened. So nobody really knows where all of this threw down. Red Sea kind of carries over, and that's what everybody knows. But the words behind it are the Sea of Reeds. They cross the Sea of Reeds. And they go like in these divisions. They march out, again, like kings. They march out like an army, going out towards there. And God stops them at the edge of the wilderness, I guess. At the edge of the desert is what it says. So do you have any other thoughts on this?
You mean through 18, through the Red Sea, or you mean through any of it?
Yeah, I mean through any of this.
So I thought the next section was kind of interesting to just suddenly bring this up, of Moses taking the bones of Joseph mm-hmm. with him. And this reminded me, I'm not sure, I can't remember on the podcast, did we read any of the end of Genesis? Because the very end of Genesis is talking about Joseph's death.
Yep.
And how he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. So it's not like Moses had to go off somewhere and retrieve his body. It was already there in Egypt where they were when they were leaving Egypt. And so to me, I was like, you know, this would have been a long time after Joseph died. And so it just feels like, who was like, oh, Moses, did you get the body? Did you get the bones?
Yeah.
And it feels like they would need to have some sort of like leaving Egypt checklist.
Yes.
And where they're like, no, don't bring the yeast. Ask the Egyptians for like silver and gold, or you know, whatever you want.
Hey Aaron, did you get the bones?
Who has the body?
Who got
the bones?
Who's got Joseph? You know?
Yeah, like who was responsible for like making sure that happened?
I mean it has been a long time.
Yeah, so it yeah. just I thought that was an interesting little thing to kind of stick in here. But I think the emphasis here is really that like Joseph knew this was going to happen. And this is just showing again the fulfillment of God's promises.
Yeah.
And he's ready, you know, to have Joseph's bones taken to the promised land too.
Yeah. And I think when we think about this stuff, it's not that Joseph was like given some premonition of like, I mean, he is a dreamer, you know, like that's part of his story. But it wasn't like a dream that he was given that he's going to be in the promised land. Hey, God's going to come and get you. It's inherently a belief that Yahweh keeps his promises. Mm-hmm. And he did promise that we were going to inherit the land. And he told our ancestors, 400 years, you're going to be in Egypt. He said that, you know, so it's not like that he's like had this vision seeing in the future. He's trusting a promise of the past and saying that Yahweh's going to come get you. Did he tell me that outright? No, but I know his promises. I know his promise was that he was going to come get you. That's what was handed down to us. And he's going to come get you, and he's going to take you to the land that he promised our fathers. And so as he's dying, he's telling them this story. And he's saying, take me with you whenever you go, so that I can be there too.
Yeah.
And so there's something to be said about that. Actually, yeah. Hebrews thinks there's something to be said about that too. So the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, whenever they're going through like, hey, here's all the heroes of faith kind of thing. Joseph gets mentioned, in verse 22, it says, by faith, Joseph, as he was dying, mentioned about the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave instructions about his bones. And so the instruction that's given there, Hebrews says that that's Joseph's faith.
Yeah,
it's Joseph's faith in God to say that I know that he's going to come get you because of who he is and because he keeps his promises.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really cool aspect of this scripture.
Yeah. So and then this last little bit with the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, I think just from a practical standpoint, it's really cool to think about how maybe the pillar of cloud was providing them shade as they're in the desert, maybe to try to help cool them off. And then the pillar of fire, maybe it was a little cooler at night, and maybe it would have provided them a little bit of warmth, but also just obviously light.
Yeah.
So that they could continue traveling at night if they needed to. And I think for me, verse 22 is another one of those verses where, you know, I think I had one last chapter where it's like, if you put this on your Instagram page or wrote it on your mirror, it might seem a little weird, but it's one of the most profound scriptures in this chapter to me. It's neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. And yeah, I mean, can you imagine writing that on your mirror and people being like, what's with that? If I just wrote that on social media, it might not carry a lot of weight. But the having the context here of just God does not leave his people.
Yep.
He is sticking with them day and night, and he's leading them. And I just think that that is a beautiful picture, again, of his faithfulness to these people who are going to, you know, continue to doubt him and who haven't been perfect either. And it's just, I think it's a good reminder for myself that that God is always with us.
Yeah.
And that he's guiding us even maybe in obscure ways.
Yeah. And I love the imagery is just something that really sticks out to me, especially as you read a lot of different stories, as you read all the stories in the scriptures, it's like this cloud and fire. Where have I seen cloud and fire before? So just one thing that comes to mind is whenever Abraham says, you know, he God takes him and he's like, hey, I'm going to make you a great nation, and the world's going to be blessed through you. And Abraham, you know, like, talks to God, and he's like, how can I know that you're going to do these things? And what the story says is that he tells Abraham, go get a heifer. And cut the heifer in half, and all these other animals, cut them in half and lay them in a row. And what it is, it's a covenant scene. God cuts a covenant with Abraham. And what ends up happening is that he puts Abraham into a deep sleep. And so Abraham's like having this vision of what's happening in front of him. There's these, you know, dead carcasses, and he has this vision of this smoking pot and fire that passes through the pieces. And so God makes a covenant with Abraham right there to say that as surely as I live, I'm going to fulfill this promise. And should I not, then may I be what happened to these carcasses. That's what he's saying. And he doesn't require Abraham to pass through the pieces. That's usually how it would go. Abraham would pass through the pieces, swearing loyalty to this greater being and saying, as surely as, you know, like if I don't fulfill this covenant, then may I end up like these carcasses. Instead, the roles are swapped, and Yahweh passes through as a smoking pot and a fire, right? And a torch passes through. So this imagery has occurred before in the scriptures. And I'm thinking forward to whenever they have the tabernacle. We'll touch on this later in Exodus. When they do have the tabernacle, and the priest would go in, there's this lamp there's a lampstand that's in there. You know, think about it being really dark when you go in because everything's like sealed off in the tabernacle. And you've got a lamp there that's lit. It has seven lights. What?
It's lit.
Yeah. It's got seven so lights trendy. On it. Yeah, seven fires on it. Seven fires that are lit in there. Sorry, I mean, it means something different.
Yeah, I know, but when I hear it now, I'm like...
So seven fires that are flaming in the...
Fires flaming.
In the tabernacle. And then you would go to the altar of incense, and you would have this incense that would smoke up. So you'd have this room basically filled with this smoke cloud and these seven lights that are filling the room. And the point is, like, all of this is symbolizing God's presence. And as they pass into the Holy of Holies, that you're just, all this cloud, smoke, and light is there in this holy place. And so what I mean, ultimately, what do these two symbols mean? I mean, they're talking about God's very presence. God's very presence is there with them as they are about to pass into the wilderness. That he's going with them. He's going before them. He's protecting them. He is being their light, man, the word light. I mean, for him to be the light that goes into the wilderness. I mean, this is pulling up Genesis chapter 1 of like, and what was the very first thing that happens? That he creates light, and there's this whole deal with chaotic waters being pushed back and dry land appearing, right? That's the next thing that's going to happen here. And so all of these things are triggering as you're reading this, especially if you've experienced the tabernacle and now you're reading the Torah and you're like, oh, okay, these are the things that are, this is God's presence. And maybe that's obvious, but I think whenever we have more of those images, brought forward to us, it fills out this presence of God even more. I love what you said there. It's just that, you know, God is there in the fire and he's there in the cloud and he's going before his people. He's there with them and he's never going to leave them.